Mr. Bernhardt, that was wonderful. Don't ever apologize because you can't direct the singing as long as you can sing like that. Don't be ashamed because you can't do one thing and can do another. I can't teach Greek, but I can teach Revelation. I hope. We'll find out in a few minutes. If not, we're going to all be in big trouble. Okay. Turn to the 18th chapter. We come tonight to the picture of the destruction of the world empire, the political confederation of evil that is probably a revived Roman Empire of 10 mighty European nations. And isn't the face of that continent changing daily? Before we do that, I want to read a couple of newspaper articles, a portion of them, some things of interest. You will recall that we have seen in Revelation at the end of the time, as the end of time, as the armies of the world converge on Israel, because Jesus has to reign ultimately in Israel, the angel said, on the throne of his father David, he'll reign. That's where he'll reign and bring peace 1,000 years on earth. The armies of the world coming into Israel to destroy Israel, and Jesus at Armageddon at the end of tribulation rescues her. And that's what causes them to believe in him, and the Armageddon then precedes the millennium. We've seen a part of the scenario in which these armies come is a 200 million man army that comes from the east. Now we saw when they get to the Euphrates River, they are bound by an angel for a year, a month, and a day. And I have suggested that probably they are held there because water causes the impossibility of their continued advance. And we've seen about 40 miles from Baghdad, as I've showed you, there's a place called Ar-Ramadi, where is a massive confluence of dams and dikes and lifts and lakes that is the water supply of Baghdad. And I've suggested the possibility that some of these earthquakes in the end of the tribulation will have knocked all of this apart, and it'll be flooded with water, and it'll take 13 months and a day until it dries up and they can go on. There may be another reason why. It may be have been purposely flooded because of some use of the river Euphrates that goes into that, which furnishes water for Iraq, which is becoming increasingly hostile against Israel every day, as you know. Maybe because of some use of that water, conflict arises and war over it, and it's blown apart or purposely bombed, and that causes the flood. Something that caused me to think that might be a possible scenario was an article that one of our folks handed me 2 weeks ago, January 13th edition of the Post. It's entitled, "Turkey to Choke Off Rivers Flow into Arid Dry," that is, neighbors Syria and Iraq. Here's a little of the story. Ankara, Turkey. Turkey today will cut off the flow of the Euphrates River, the lifeblood of ancient Mesopotamia, in a move that could lead to tensions with arid neighbors Syria and Iraq. Engineers will shut the hatches of the giant Ataturk Dam for 1 month so they can fill a reservoir to a height of 396 feet and build a concrete plug for a diversion channel as a part of a major construction project of a complex of hydroelectrical dams. How interesting. The occasion is a moment of pride and accomplishment for Turkey, which views the Southeast Anatolia construction project as the key to the economic development of the region. But the event is considered a cause for worry by Iraq and Syria, which are dependent upon the waters of the Euphrates, river 1,460 miles long. For 1 month, Syria and Iraq will receive reduced water downstream from the tributaries of the Euphrates, which is controlled by Turkey upstream, estimated to be 1/4 of the regular flow. 1/4. That's cause for international tensions, isn't it, when somebody cuts your water off upstream? Syria is more, or downstream for that matter, I guess. Syria is more dependent on the river because Iraq has the Tigris River in its territory. We know the famous Tigris and Euphrates River. But Syria is in a position to divert more of the Euphrates River to its own reservoir and allow just a trickle to Iraq. This is a problem they'll have to work out and solve among themselves, said a Turkish official who asked for anonymity. So we see the possibility of the control of that water and its dams, many of which new ones are being built, in that whole area as being a possible potential tool of war against their enemies. Turkey is on our side, as you know, and Iraq's on theirs. And so that might be a scenario that causes bombings and a terrible consequential flooding of the area that would bind the armies as well as the earthquakes. Interesting speculation, isn't it? We're going to talk tonight about Babylon. Let me read a little bit about Babylon from the Houston Post, February 15th. Now, some have suggested the possibility that the literal Babylon, which is in Iraq, will be rebuilt like Babel was built as a testimony of rebellion against God, physically rebuilt. And that the destruction of Babylon is a physical thing out of Revelation. Well, it may or may not be. But they do know the site of Babylon, of course, and there are some archaeological remnants there. Incidentally, I'll put this in my church paper, our article next week, but they have now proven archaeologically and scientifically that, in fact, the walls of Jericho did tumble down all at once, not just decay through the years. And so they know where Babylon is. There are archaeological, historical remnants, and they're going to try to beautify the area. Now, whether they would actually try to reconstruct the whole thing is quite another issue. So we don't know whether this destruction of Babylon is the destruction of a rebuilt Babylon, trying to reduplicate Babel originally, actually physically, that the Lord destroys, that he's coming, and the destruction we'll look at tonight of Babylon, or whether the destruction is intended in Scripture of spiritual Babylon, or that is the spirit of Babylon, the world system, or whether it means the literal physical city. There's no question in my opinion, it means the system of evil, not the rebuilt actual physical city. But anyway, it is interesting that they are trying to do some building and beautification and recreation of the mystique of Babylon. February 25th, Houston Post. Babylon, Iraq. Eager to reclaim the glories of its ancient past, Iraq is now translating its most fabled archaeological site into one of its biggest tourist attractions. Babylon, quote, that great city, clothed in fine linen and purple, end quote, of the Bible, Revelation specifically, has been brought back to life after a 2,000-year nap with an ambitious $25 million developmental program that has reproduced feelings of pride in Iraq and criticism from some archaeologists who fear that commercialism may diminish its value to scholars. A leading city in Mesopotamia, the fertile plain between Tigris and Euphrates rivers where Western civilization was born, Babylon was briefly the capital of one of the most powerful empires in the ancient world. Even today, it is a symbol both of lavish splendor and moral decadence. So this is not saying they're going to try to rebuild it literally, physically. I think that's biblical. I think we're talking about a spiritual Babylon here in Revelation. But it is interesting that they are making the archaeological remnant fussed up and poured over and brightened up and flowered up and advertised to make it a tourist attraction for, if nothing else, the ailing Iraqi economy. I think both of those things have some prophetical import, particularly in light of the study that we've been doing recently. So without a little bit of a background, turn to Revelation chapter 18. Revelation chapter 18. Now, chapter 18 that we shall discuss tonight and study tonight is the end of Babylon. Babylon. You will see the key is in Verse 2, and he cried this angel mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen. Now we have seen mystery Babylon fall in chapter 17. And just to review a moment, we have seen, as we said last week, that in the purging of the earth, as God finally showcases after the climactic battle of the ages in Armageddon, what life could have been like under the control of God for 1,000 years on earth, and then destroys it all and makes a new heaven and a new earth, we have seen that in that purgation process, before the rain, the showcase of peace, and then the destruction of new heaven and new earth, that there is a progressive judgment and purgation of the world. We've seen that man's environment is judged. The heavens roll up as a scroll. We've seen a third of his environment judged. Then we've seen all of it judged. The animals, the fishes of the sea and the rivers apart, and then all of them. Men dying, millions and hundreds of millions and billions dying. Now there comes the judgment in chapter 17 last week of the political, of the spiritual system of the world, the world's false religious system. And we've made some suggestions as to what that might be. And it's called Mystery Babylon. The two forces that have intertwined here are the political power, incarcerated in evil, incarcerated in a political system, and evil incarcerated in a religious system. Now, this is natural because we do know the Antichrist will be a political leader and a religious leader. And he will take over the world politically for this brief period of time. But then his religiousness will come out. He'll go on and say, I'm more than a political hero. I am a God. Worship me. That's when Jesus comes for Armageddon. Now, in chapter 16, verse 7, we saw last week, chapter 16, verse 17, at the end of chapter 17, the words, it is done. That is the end of the world's judgment physically. The environment, the stars, the heaven, the ocean, the planets, and everything physical related thereto. Now in chapter 17, we saw the destruction of the world's religious, false religious system, and tonight we'll see the destruction of the world's false political system. They're both called Babylon, the incarnation of evil, in a system, not in a man, that's the Antichrist, but in a system. But in chapter 17, it was called Mystery Babylon. I think that refers to the mystique of spiritual things. And so that is the religious system. And this is the destruction of not Mystery Babylon, but just plain Babylon, the confederated world evil political system. And that is what is in view here tonight. Now back again in chapter 17, verse 7. The angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman, and the mystery, and of the beast that carried her. And now he tells the mystery of the woman in the rest of the chapter, spiritual Babylon, the religious system. And in 18 verse 1, he tells us, and following, what the beast was that carried her, the political system. And so we saw last week that the imagery of the religious system riding on the back, so to speak, of the political system, that is, controlling it. We shall see the time comes when the political system rebels and destroys Mystery Babylon, the harlot, and turns against all religion. And so tonight we begin to see this destruction of this world's political system called Babylon. In the Old Testament, the ultimate, the first world's organized system of disobedience and rebellion against God. There were others. Adam sinned individually. Eve sinned individually. Cain sinned individually. They all sinned individually. But the first organized system of rebellion was the Tower of Babel, where God said, go out across the earth and repopulate the earth. They said, we won't do it. We're staying here. And so the Tower of Babel, or Babel, became the symbol throughout Scripture of organize rebellion and disobedience and sin against God. The word means confusion, because their God confused them. The Hebrew word is Babel or Babel. The New Testament Greek form is Babylon. It is the personification of Babel or Babel. Ecclesiastical, religious Babylon is called the Great Whore or the Great Harlot, Mystery Babylon. Political Babylon that we shall look at this week is the last world, the last Gentile world power. And it is the one that, as we saw from it, arises in the revelation of the Antichrist, who has been controlling it and its motivating factor behind it. When he emerges himself and says, I'm God, that triggers off Armageddon. So this is political Babylon, governmental Babylon. And if you look at humanism and liberal courts and their rulings in everything from the theater to education, there is no question that sin and rebellion against God and license to do as you please, and that's what rebellion and sin is, license to do as you please, is incarnated in our political system and in the systems of the world, and will be even more. It comes together with such a confederation centered in Europe and the revised Roman Empire in Daniel's ten toes, which we saw at the end of it, that the great stone of the ages comes and crushes when we studied Daniel, the coming of Christ at Armageddon, that it becomes more than a simply identifiable political system with a geographical base, likely Europe, but it is actually the incarnation of all evil in one essence. Now back to chapter 17, verse 18. When I called you back last week and gave you a P.S., I hope you were back and remember. The woman, he said, this religious system, Mystery Babylon, is that great city. What great city? Well, Jerusalem is called that great city, and there is certainly the spirit there of Jerusalem, its works, its rejection of Christ. Rome may view and be in view here with its system of so much that is foreign, we believe, to New Testament Christianity. Historical Babylon, physically, may be in view here. But you will recall that at the end of each of the seven vials, of the seven scrolls, the seven vials, and seven trumpets, that what happens is the summation of everything that has happened. So I suggested to you last week that the great city refers to the spirit of Rome, the spirit and theology and practice of historical Babylon, Babel, and the spirit of Jerusalem, which is against Christ, or certainly non-Christ. And that the great city then refers to a spiritual city and an incarnation all at once of everything that has ever been religiously anti-God. And so it is the same way then when you come down to the plagues, they're as hard as everything that's always ever been before. The incarnation of this religious system, the great harlot, is as serious and inculcates everything that's been before. And just so I think here, I think the judgment of Babylon, the organized world system of rebellion politically against God, is the incarnation and essence of, spiritually, and the sum total of, all the rebellion that has ever gone on before. And it is so bad when God judges it that he gives it twice what it ever gave out throughout all of history. Now with that background, gee, that's enough for a whole sermon, isn't it? All right. With that background, let's jump in and look at some verses here. And I want to tell you, this is a long chapter, but it will go very quickly. The two major portions only need to be read with one or two small comments. All right? And so the destruction of the spirit of organized, political, world confederation of rebellion against God, crushed once and for all, which is culminated by the Antichrist as they all come to destroy what is the essence of God's revelation of himself through all the Judeo-Christian faith, is smashed once and for all. So here's the judgment of that world system of organized rebellion politically against God. Verse 1. And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven. Now let's keep in mind, let's look at the word angel, that this is prophetical language. It is some things I think we can firmly say, I really with conviction believe that's literal. Because it's so obvious. We have seen, have we not? So much obvious. And so much explained clearly from other parts of Revelation and particularly of the Old Testament. But some is obviously metaphorical, allegorical, mystical, and is illusionary and unsure. And we've seen already, you will recall, that an angel, the word angel here is used several times, for good angels. Personifications, this is important, that God created personages he created to do his bidding. We've also seen the word angels used for what he calls beasts, bad angels, grotesque, in rebellion against God, unwilling to be his instruments and servants, called beasts. But do you recall that we have, and I just remember this moment ago coming in, so I don't know where it is, but I do recall we have also studied and seen the expression angel used once for Jesus, remember? Now, in the Old Testament, there's somebody who appears often who's called the angel of the Lord. Now, we think that this may be just a name for pre-incarnate Old Testament appearances of Jesus, because he always acts like Jesus. But now, if you ever heard anything, hear this. This is symbolic language. I'm going to suggest to you the possibility that interchange of terminology is used here, and this angel is a name for Jesus, and that this is Jesus. I'll show you why in a minute. But you must hear this clearly. That is not to say, not to say, not to say that Jesus is an angel or is like an angel. This is symbolic language. And we've seen that already once and then repeatedly in the Old Testament and once in Revelation, he is pictured in the imagery as an angel. Now, why is it important that you understand that Jesus is not an angel? Well, one of the big reasons is, like the man I had lunch with today, who is a Mormon, and the difference in what they believe and what evangelical Christianity believes. Be not deceived, even Satan himself will come transformed as an angel of light. You will see a continued proliferation of confusing miracles, manifestations, everything of Satan as an angel of light, and you won't be able to tell which it is. The New Age movement is full of it, and it's confusing a lot of people. This man was talking about the beauty of Jesus, the greatness of giving your testimony, the joy of preaching the gospel. But folks, the Mormons don't mean what you mean by the gospel. They don't mean what you mean by accepting Christ. They're not talking about the same Christ you are. They don't mean the same Jesus we mean. The Jesus that they're talking about is the one that their doctrine says began as a human being created by God. Created by God, put in the garden, who evolved into a God. So we can too, they say, and became a God. That is not the doctrine of the New Testament. The doctrine of the New Testament is that Jesus, get this, is not a created being. God did not create Jesus. He was his only begotten Son, only in the sense of his incarnation in the human body for 33 years. But the touchstone, it's no side issue. The watershed of all Christian orthodoxy is that Jesus is, will always be, and has always been fully God. Co-equal with God. God didn't create Jesus. Jesus didn't create God. The Father, Son, and Spirit are eternal. They have always been. So don't think for one moment that when we talk about accepting Jesus and they talk about accepting Jesus, that we mean what the Mormons mean. Which Jesus are you talking about accepting? The one who is eternal, God, and has always been the creator of the world, or the one who God created that they believe who started out as a man and evolved into God? How important is it? It's only the heart of Christian orthodoxy. If any man deny that Jesus is God in the flesh, co-equal with the Father, he is of Antichrist, John says, and is of the devil. There's a fine line here. I've said that to say this. When I suggest to you that this reference to an angel, and I'll embellish that in a moment, maybe, some of you are saying, what have you been doing the last 5 minutes? Maybe Jesus, remember, I say that in the sense of New Testament apocalyptic imagery, not New Testament theology. And that's very, very important. So I saw this other angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. The word that I am reading, lightened, in my King James Version, does not mean made to weigh less, lightened up, weight removed. It means the earth was illuminated, lighted up. Now, I want to suggest to you that this angel may be Jesus Christ, for three or four reasons. Number one, he is seen as having great power. Two, he has a mighty voice, not just the voice of the angels, a mighty voice. He is the voice of God. Both of those things are not referenced to other angels. Number three, he lightens up the earth. He illuminates the earth. No angel as pictured in the Bible as having such dazzling Shekinah glory that he lights up the whole world. Number four, the Father judgeth no man, but hath committed all judgment to the Son. Is it not reasonable to assume that when the final destruction of the organized world system of rebellion is crushed, that God sends his no less an authority than Jesus to do it himself? Hypothetical. Bassanio's opinion. But here are four reasons why I suggest the possibility. Jesus is this mighty angel. And he cried with a mighty voice, with a strong voice, saying, Babylon, the great is fallen. Turn back, if you will, please, to chapter 14, verse 8. And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city. Now in chapter 14, which is parenthetical, we have an overview of what is going to happen. All right? We have the detailed record of what did happen. And guess what? It's precisely the same thing. Here comes this mighty angel that illuminates the earth, that brings ultimate judgment on the destruction of this organized system of world rebellion against God. And he says, Babylon the Great. This is not Babylon the Whore. This is not mystery Babylon. That's the organized system of religion. This is the organized political system. Babylon the Great is fallen. It is characteristic of the Greek language that it does not use a lot of hyperbole and adjectives and so forth to be descriptive. Or adverbs, it just simply repeats for emphasis. What in this world has Jesus Christ been about from the beginning of time? The destruction of Babylon. The elimination of rebellion and sin and evil. That's what the garden was about. That's what the prophecies were about. That's what the imagery was about. That's what the Passover was about. That's what the system of Judaism was about. That's what the prophets were about. That's what the cross was about. And that's what it's all about. The red evil in the human personality and in the world, in the environment, and in the organized religion, and now in the organized political system. I mean, he's going to purge it and clean it all before he rules. And so, for purposes of emphasis and for glory that it's over and done, Babylon the Great, he says, is fallen. What's left of it? It's become the habitation of devils, that would seem to be demons, and the hold of every foul spirit. I do not know what the difference here is in demons and foul spirits, unless the demon is the real personification of the devils, and the foul spirit is perhaps just may indicate a spirit of rebellion, a spirit of evil in man. You know, if a child is said to have a spirit of rebellion, or an adult is said to have a spirit of fear, there are those who would try to personify everything and cast out the demon of fear or the demon of rebellion. I do not think that is congruent with New Testament theology. Every personality attribute is not a personification of evil and a demon. This may indicate such a division, that some are and some aren't. But every evil, bad, stinking, rotten, awful, rebellious thing in the world has fallen within this system, and that's what's left in this world. And a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. Well, two kinds of birds here. The Old Testament said a lot about creatures of the night as symbols and pictures of evil, because the night is Satan's bailiwick. He's the prince of darkness. So unclean bird may be in view here. And then hateful bird. Even those animals with any kind of an antagonistic spirit. You say, are there any hateful birds? Well, if you've got a canary or a dove, that's a nice bird. But if you're out hunting and you accidentally knock down a bluebird, you better run for your life. Because every bluebird in the field will attack you. There are hateful birds, there are biblically unclean birds, and perhaps all of this is just imagery for the complete awe and empty horridness of what remains when the destruction of evil occurs. Because it's not a destruction, you see, of the animal kingdom that he's after. It's a destruction of, that's the environment of man's rebellion. And when that's left, the spirit is there. Demons have not yet been cast into hell and are there. Foul spirits, unclean and hateful birds. I think it's imagery for saying how awful is the desolation. Verse 3, for all nations, why does this happen? Why is God so angry at this organized system of rebellion against God? Because it has infected the whole world. For all nations, because the reason is why? Because all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The whole world has been infected with organized evil. And their leaders have brought it about. The kings of the earth, or a king is a person who rules a kingdom, have committed fornication with her, with this Babylon. And the merchants of the earth, it's affected business, are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. That's making profit off of organized evil. Does America make any profit out of organized evil? The third biggest industry in the nation is drugs. What about the mafia? What about Playboy and penthouse and bars and where do you stop? Child pornography. All pornography. Verse 4, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, oh, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, that ye receive not of her plagues. Now, this is interesting. Come out of her, my people. Well, yes, that's good preaching. Let me tell you what it means. We have in view here the end of the tribulation. Antichrist is in control. God is judging and smashing this world. And there are still, to the last minute, people being saved by rejecting the Antichrist and rejecting the mark of the beast. And here, now those who would be beheaded would have been already come out of her and under the altar safe in heaven. But those he is preaching to, saying, come out of her, judgment's falling, I think are those who are the predestined saints. Those are who are yet to be saved. See, this is an exhortation to those who are still hanging on, deciding whether to take the mark of the beast or not. It's about all over, he says. This whole system's going to fall. You that are predestined to be saved, you that are mine, that are marked for salvation from the end of the beginning, from the beginning of time, come out of this while there's time. Don't get hooked up in it. You're my people. See, this, I think, is an invitation to those who are his people who have not yet received him, but who are marked to receive him. I think we can pray for our sons and daughters, that they are God's people, marked, ordained, destined to be saved, but have not yet actually accepted him, that they will come out of the world and fulfill their great heritage and be saved. That's what he's saying here. For all the nations, well, I missed something here I want to say. Back in verse 3, they've committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. The expression abundance of her delicacies means the power of her luxury. Is there power in luxury that has caused the people of the earth to be intoxicated with a world system of rebellion against God? You turn on the lifestyles of the rich and famous. Is our world not obsessed with people who, because of the power of abundance, are pulled and attracted into this world system? Verse 5, for her sins come out of her. You don't receive the plagues and judgments that are fixing to come on her right now. The axe is ready to drop because her sins have reached unto heaven and God hath remembered her iniquities. Sins reach to heaven. I remember that language around the subject of the Tower of Babel in the Old Testament. Remember? Their iniquity, their sins reached up to heaven. The imagery here is that the wrath of God is filled up to the cup. In other words, God has had it. Therefore, man's had it. We've seen the imagery repeatedly, that the cup of indignation is full. The cup of wrath is brimming. The vial of God's judgment is about to overflow. And he says, God's had it up to here. Get out of it. The end is here. Reward her even as she rewarded you. Get this, and double unto her. Verse 4, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people. Would this be God speaking to his son, to whom he has committed judgment, who is now saying in verse 6, reward her. Who's talking to whom? Is not this the father saying to the son, reward her, son, give her back as she has rewarded you. The way the world has treated you, Jesus, pour back on the world, double unto her, according to her works. In the cup which she hath filled to her, double. How much she hath glorified herself, this world, and lived deliciously. So much torment and sorrow give her. To the degree she has lived in sin and its pleasures, give her judgment and its displeasures. For she saith in her heart, I sit a queen. I'm no widow, I'm no beggar, I'm a queen. And shall see no sorrow. See, the world is so smug, it thinks it's immune. I never pay for my sins. Verse 8, therefore, because she feels that way, shall her plagues come in one day. Death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord who judgeth her. I want to underscore the word one day. This word day may mean many things. It may mean 24 hours. This is prophetic language. I realize that Genesis might have been, some say. I don't think so. That's not prophecy. That's history. This is prophetic language, so you can say with safety, this may be one 24-hour period. But in prophetic language, we've seen repeatedly through Daniel, remember, that an hour or a week is simply some kind of a reference to a period of time. Now, I'm going to suggest to you the possibility that one day here, one period of quick destruction of time, is in fact clarified as 1 hour of time later on in the chapter. So keep that in view. Therefore shall her plagues come quickly, in an instant, in a day, in an hour, whatever. Death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord who judgeth her. All right, now the rest of the chapter is going to go very quickly. Verse 1 through 8 is what's going to happen. Now get this. The rest of the chapter is divided in two parts, two responses to what happens. One is the view of man, the human response, from down here on the ranch, on earth, meanwhile back of the ranch. The human view, the human response to this judgment of the world system of organized evil. That's verse 9 through 19. Verse 20 through the end of the chapter is the heavenly view of what's happening. So get that down. Verse 1 to 8 is the picture of the destruction of the system. Verse 9 to 19 is the earthly view of that destruction. And verse 20 to 24 is heaven's perspective of that. Now, as we look at these views quickly, first of all, I'm going to just read the earthly view. Here's what the people on earth, here's their opinion of what's going on in this final judgment. Verse 9, and the kings of the earth, which have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her, shall wail her, bewail, and lament for her. Oh, everything's gone. My treasures, my wealth, my yacht, my house in the Riviera, it's all gone. And they shall see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, the great city Babylon. See, they're still mourning this wonderful, evil world system, Babylon, that mighty city. For in 1 hour is thy judgment come. And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her. No more money for them to make. For no man buyeth their merchandise anymore. The merchandise of gold and of silver and precious stones and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and all fine wood and all manner vessels of ivory and all manner vessels of most precious wood and of brass and of iron and marble and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense and wine and oil and fine flour and wheat and beasts and sheep and horses and the chariots and slaves, the souls of men. All gone. And the fruits that thy soul lusteth after are departed from thee, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more. The merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off for fear of her tormenting, weeping, and wailing, and say, alas, alas, that great city, it's all gone, that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour so great riches has come to naught. All over in an hour. And every shipmaster and all the company and ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like unto this great city? And they cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, alas, alas, the great city wherein were made all were made rich, all that had ships in the sea, by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour is she made desolate. That's the world's sad view. You see, everything they had that they thought was valuable is gone in an hour. Let me call three or four things to your attention from this passage. First of all, how quickly it happens. Verse 10, 1 hour, verse 17, 1 hour, the end of verse 19, 1 hour, three times for emphasis it is said. I think what's called one day up here just may refer to one period of time, one fell swoop, maybe just a concept. Like say, well, so-and-so had his day in court. Doesn't mean it was specifically 24 hours in the courtroom. Just had his day. Well, this is prophetical language, so that may be in view here. But the bottom line is, it is so quick. What they have built for hundreds and thousands of years and inherited from their parents and worked for and given their whole life to, in an hour is gone. And then another thing I want to point out to you is the end of verse 13. All these things are gone. And look at the end of the verse. Chariots and slaves and the souls of men. Uh-oh, we almost ran over that, didn't we? As though, you see, to the nonchalant, non-caring world, just nonchalant, pitched in the list, and the souls of men. Just nothing. How valuable is human life in such a world system? Not valuable at all. It just made a fleeting reference from the world's perspective. Look how deep is the longing, verse 14, and the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee. All the treasures and possessions that in the deepest longing of men's soul they set their mind and soul on, all gone. All gone. And how quickly? 1 hour. You're seeing Gone with the Wind. They say it's the greatest movie ever made in America. I personally like the Ten Commandments. Somebody gave it to us for Christmas. We'd never seen it all the way through. I think my favorite part's where old Clark says, frankly, my dear, I don't, you know that part. Well, it's a tragedy, and it is a four-hour picture in a little southern area of America, of the whole world. Gone with the wind. Now, what is heaven's response? Verse 20 to 24. Rejoice over her, thou heaven. Be glad she's gone. And you apostles and prophets, you New Testament and you Old Testament believers who champion the cause of righteousness, be glad you won and she's gone. And God hath avenged you on her. He poured out his defense and vengeance, avengingness of what was right that you did on his behalf upon her. God hath avenged you. It doesn't say God took revenge for your sake on her. There's a big difference in avenge and revenge. To revenge has a spirit about it of getting even. To avenge has no emotional tie at all, no emotional implication at all. It just means to set things right. Because of you, what you did for me, for you I have now done this for you and set things right. And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone. And can you see the imagery of this angel, 10 times taller than the earth perhaps, with something in his arm that is bigger than the whole earth, a millstone, and he casts it into the sea, saying, with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all. Why the sea? Why not right on Babylon? Because we're talking about a spirit of rebellion, the spirit of Babylon, and the sea, and it's a spirit of money, and the sea is the avenue of money. All trade, all delicacies, all purple, all gold was bought and traded and sold through the seas. The seas were everything. It's now smashed. Saying, thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all. After Armageddon, what happens? A 1,000-year reign. Is the spirit of Babylon on this earth anymore? Is the spirit of Babylon in the millennium? Is the spirit of Babylon in eternity? Is there an organized system of rebellion against God after Armageddon? Of course not. It's no more at all. Listen to how grateful. Listen to the response of heaven. And the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and of trumpeters shall be no more at all in thee, Babylon. And no craftsmen, those who would craft the finest things, of whatever craft he be, no more anymore at all. And the sound of a millstone, that would be our equivalent to heavy industry, shall be heard no more at all in thee. Get this. And the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee. You see, Babylon is darkness. Satan's kingdom is an evil kingdom of darkness. He's the prince of the darkness. And there's not even a light, a speck of righteousness. I want to show you something else. I think the imagery may mean there's not even a speck of a witness to the light. Because he says, and the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. What is the voice of the bride and the bridegroom? Well, one of two things. Three things. First of all, it could mean there's no joy. There's no celebrating. There's no happiness. You see, all the bands have gone out. All the lights have been turned off. All the clubs have been shut down. All the plugs have been pulled on the TV. Nobody's making any movies. All the world knows of happiness, the plug's been pulled on it. So it could mean there's no happiness. It could mean there's no more marriage. No voice of the bride, no voice of the bridegroom. The end of everything. It's the end of the world system. It's the end of the world's religion. It's the end of craftsmanship and heavy industry and the universe. It's the end of the basic institution of all life, marriage. Nobody to marry. It's all judged. But it could be that it means the voice of the bridegroom, that's Jesus, and of the bride, that's us, shall be no more heard. Because the bridegroom, Jesus, is not ministering and appealing. He's judging. And the voice of the bride, us, is not here because it's gone. We're raptured. It could mean any of those things. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth. For by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. Now this is the word pharmakeia again, in which we get drugs. It could mean a mighty onslaught of the deception of unreality. The perception of unreality altered by world on drugs has deceived everybody. It could simply be the deception of evil has deceived everybody. And what was found inside this great Babylon? When they opened her up, the blood of Old and New Testament believers, and of all them, and of all that were slain upon the earth. Not only has organized evil, are you going to like this? Not only has organized rebellion against God been in opposition with God and his people and has killed the prophets and the saints, but it's killed its own, hasn't it? It's ground its own. And of all that were slain on the earth. You're going to love this. Get ready for next week. Come with your seat belts buckled down. What's the result of all this? I want to finish with a grand so what, okay? Evil's done. It's gone. They're moaning on earth. They're shouting in heaven. What about us? What's the grand so what of all this? Chapter 19, verse 1, and after these things, I heard a great voice of much people in heaven saying, hallelujah! What else can you say? When righteousness reigns and Jesus is Lord and evil and the devil's in hell and evil and destruction that's ground men underfoot is all judged and crushed and over, but hallelujah! Our God reigneth. The final victory of the Lord righteous over the unrighteous world system of rebellion and sin can only be exclaimed with a final, consummate punctuation mark of the children of God with one grand hallelujah. Hallelujah. All right? Bring your seat belts. Next week is lots of hallelujahs. We're going to have a good time. Let's stand. I think we'll just stand.
The following sermon by Dr. John Bisogno has been recorded and produced by the Resource Center of First Baptist Church, Houston. For copies of this or any other taped message by Dr. Bisogno, please write to First Baptist Church Tape Ministry, Post Office Box 55158, Houston, Texas, 77255.
Mr. Bernhardt, that was wonderful. Don't ever apologize because you can't direct the singing as long as you can sing like that. Don't be ashamed because you can't do one thing and can do another. I can't teach Greek, but I can teach Revelation. I hope. We'll find out in a few minutes. If not, we're going to all be in big trouble. Okay. Turn to the 18th chapter. We come tonight to the picture of the destruction of the world empire, the political confederation of evil. That is probably a revived Roman Empire of 10 mighty European nations, and isn't the face of that continent changing daily? Before we do that, I want to read a couple of newspaper articles, a portion of them, some things of interest. You will recall that we have seen in Revelation at the end of the time, as the end of time, as the armies of the world converge on Israel, because Jesus has to reign ultimately in Israel, the angel said, on the throne of his father David, he'll reign. That's where he'll reign and bring peace 1,000 years on earth. The armies of the world coming into Israel to destroy Israel. And Jesus at Armageddon at the end of tribulation rescues her, and that's what causes them to believe in him, and the Armageddon then precedes the millennium. We've seen a part of the scenario in which these armies come is a 200 million man army that comes from the east. Now we saw when they get to the Euphrates River, they are bound by an angel for a year, a month, and a day. And I have suggested that probably they are held there because water causes the impossibility of their continued advance. And we've seen about 40 miles from Baghdad, as I've showed you, there's a place called Ar-Ramadi, where is a massive confluence of dams and dikes and lifts and lakes that is the water supply of Baghdad. And I've suggested the possibility that some of these earthquakes in the end of the tribulation will have knocked all of this apart, and it'll be flooded with water, and it'll take 13 months and a day until it dries up and they can go on. There may be another reason why. It may have been purposely flooded because of some use of the river Euphrates that goes into that, which furnishes water for Iraq, which is becoming increasingly hostile against Israel every day, as you know. Maybe because of some use of that water, conflict arises and war over it, and it's blown apart or purposely bombed, and that causes the flood. Something that caused me to think that might be a possible scenario was an article that one of our folks handed me 2 weeks ago, January 13th edition of The Post. It's entitled, "Turkey to Choke Off Rivers Flow into Arid Dry," that is, neighbors Syria and Iraq. Here's a little of the story. Ankara, Turkey. Turkey today will cut off the flow of the Euphrates River, the lifeblood of ancient Mesopotamia, in a move that could lead to tensions with arid neighbors, Syria and Iraq. Engineers will shut the hatches of the giant Ataturk Dam for 1 month so they can fill a reservoir to a height of 396 feet and build a concrete plug for a diversion channel as a part of a major construction project of a complex of hydroelectrical dams. How interesting. The occasion is a moment of pride and accomplishment for Turkey, which views the Southeast Anatolia construction project as the key to the economic development of the region. But the event is considered a cause for worry by Iraq and Syria, which are dependent upon the waters of the Euphrates, river 1,460 miles long. For 1 month, Syria and Iraq will receive reduced water downstream from the tributaries of the Euphrates, which is controlled by Turkey upstream, estimated to be 1/4 of the regular flow. 1/4. That's cause for international tensions, isn't it, when somebody cuts your water off upstream? Syria is more, or downstream for that matter, I guess. Syria is more dependent on the river because Iraq has the Tigris River in its territory. We know the famous Tigris and Euphrates River. But Syria is in a position to divert more of the Euphrates River to its own reservoir and allow just a trickle to Iraq. This is a problem they'll have to work out and solve among themselves, said a Turkish official who asked for anonymity. So we see the possibility of the control of that water and its dams, many of which new ones are being built, in that whole area as being a possible potential tool of war against their enemies. Turkey is on our side, as you know, and Iraq's on theirs. And so that might be a scenario that causes bombings and a terrible consequential flooding of the area that would bind the armies as well as the earthquakes. Interesting speculation, isn't it? We're going to talk tonight about Babylon. Let me read a little bit about Babylon from the Houston Post, February 15th. Now, some have suggested the possibility that the literal Babylon, which is in Iraq, will be rebuilt like Babel was built as a testimony of rebellion against God, physically rebuilt. And that the destruction of Babylon is a physical thing out of Revelation. Well, it may or may not be. But they do know the site of Babylon, of course, and there are some archaeological remnants there. Incidentally, I'll put this in my church paper, our article next week, but they have now proven archaeologically and scientifically that, in fact, the walls of Jericho did tumble down all at once, not just decay through the years. And so they know where Babylon is. There are archaeological, historical remnants, and they're going to try to beautify the area. Now, whether they would actually try to reconstruct the whole thing is quite another issue. So we don't know whether this destruction of Babylon is the destruction of a rebuilt Babylon, trying to reduplicate Babel originally, actually physically, that the Lord destroys, that he's coming, and the destruction we'll look at tonight of Babylon, or whether the destruction is intended in Scripture of spiritual Babylon, or that is the spirit of Babylon, the world system, or whether it means the literal physical city. There's no question in my mind, my opinion, it means the system of evil, not the rebuilt actual physical city. But anyway, it is interesting that they are trying to do some building and beautification and recreation of the mystique of Babylon. February 25th, Houston Post. Babylon, Iraq. Eager to reclaim the glories of its ancient past, Iraq is now translating its most fabled archaeological site into one of its biggest tourist attractions. Babylon, quote, that great city, clothed in fine linen and purple, end quote, of the Bible, Revelation specifically, has been brought back to life after a 2,000-year nap with an ambitious $25 million developmental program that has reproduced feelings of pride in Iraq and criticism from some archaeologists who fear that commercialism may diminish its value to scholars. A leading city in Mesopotamia, the fertile plain between Tigris and Euphrates rivers where Western civilization was born, Babylon was briefly the capital of one of the most powerful empires in the ancient world. Even today, it is a symbol both of lavish splendor and moral decadence. So this is not saying they're going to try to rebuild it literally, physically. I think that's biblical. I think we're talking about a spiritual Babylon here in Revelation. But it is interesting that they are making the archaeological remnant fussed up and poured over and brightened up and flowered up and advertised to make it a tourist attraction for, if nothing else, the ailing Iraqi economy. I think both of those things have some prophetical import, particularly in light of the study that we've been doing recently. So with that little bit of a background, turn to Revelation chapter 18. Revelation chapter 18. Now, chapter 18 that we shall discuss tonight and study tonight is the end of Babylon. Babylon. You will see the key is in verse 2. And he cried, this angel, mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen. Now, we have seen mystery Babylon fall in chapter 17. And just to review a moment, we have seen, as we said last week, that in the purging of the earth, as God finally showcases after the climactic battle of the ages in Armageddon, what life could have been like under the control of God for 1,000 years on earth, and then destroys it all and makes a new heaven and a new earth, we have seen that in that purgation process, before the rain, the showcase of peace, and then the destruction of new heaven and new earth, that there is a progressive judgment and purgation of the world. We've seen that man's environment is judged. The heavens roll up as a scroll. We've seen a third of his environment judged. Then we've seen all of it judged. The animals, the fishes of the sea and the rivers apart, and then all of them. Men dying, millions and hundreds of millions and billions dying. Now there comes the judgment in chapter 17 last week of the political, of the spiritual system of the world, the world's false religious system. And we've made some suggestions as to what that might be. And it's called Mystery Babylon. The two forces that have intertwined here are the political power incarcerated in evil, incarcerated in a political system, and evil incarcerated in a religious system. Now, this is natural because we do know the Antichrist will be a political leader and a religious leader, and he will take over the world politically for this brief period of time, but then his religiousness will come out. He'll go on and say, I'm more than a political hero. I am a God. Worship me. That's when Jesus comes for Armageddon. Now, in chapter 16, verse 7, we saw last week, chapter 16, verse 17, at the end of chapter 17, the words, it is done. That is the end of the world's judgment physically. The environment, the stars, the heaven, the ocean, the planets, and everything physical related thereto. Now, in chapter 17, we saw the destruction of the world's religious, false religious system, and tonight we'll see the destruction of the world's false political system. They're both called Babylon, the incarnation of evil, in a system, not in a man, that's the Antichrist, but in a system. But in chapter 17, it was called Mystery Babylon. I think that refers to the mystique of spiritual things. And so that is the religious system, and this is the destruction of not mystery Babylon, but just plain Babylon, the confederated world evil political system. And that is what is in view here tonight. Now back again in chapter 17, verse 7. The angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman, and the mystery, and of the beast that carried her. And now he tells the mystery of the woman in the rest of the chapter, spiritual Babylon, the religious system. And in 18 verse 1, he tells us, and following, what the beast was that carried her, the political system. And so we saw last week that the imagery of the religious system riding on the back, so to speak, of the political system, that is, controlling it. We shall see the time comes when the political system rebels and destroys mystery Babylon, the harlot, and turns against all religion. And so tonight we begin to see this destruction of this world's political system called Babylon. In the Old Testament, the ultimate, the first world's organized system of disobedience and rebellion against God. There were others. Adam sinned individually. Eve sinned individually. Cain sinned individually. They all sinned individually. But the first organized system of rebellion was the Tower of Babel, where God said, go out across the earth and repopulate the earth. They said, we won't do it. We're staying here. And so the Tower of Babel, or Babel, became the symbol throughout Scripture of organized rebellion and disobedience and sin against God. The word means confusion, because their God confused them. The Hebrew word is Babel or Babel. The New Testament Greek form is Babylon. It is the personification of Babel or Babel. Ecclesiastical, religious Babylon is called the great whore or the great harlot, mystery Babylon. Political Babylon that we shall look at this week is the last world, the last Gentile world power. And it is the one that, as we saw from it, arises in the revelation of the Antichrist, who has been controlling it and its motivating factor behind it. When he emerges himself and says, I'm God, that triggers off Armageddon. So this is political Babylon, governmental Babylon. And if you look at humanism and liberal courts and their rulings in everything from the theater to education, there is no question that sin and rebellion against God and license to do as you please, and that's what rebellion and sin is, license to do as you please, is incarnated in our political system and in the systems of the world, and will be even more. It comes together with such a confederation centered in Europe and the revised Roman Empire in Daniel's ten toes, which we saw at the end of it, that the great stone of the ages comes and crushes, when we studied Daniel, the coming of Christ at Armageddon, that it becomes more than a simply identifiable political system with a geographical base, likely Europe, but it is actually the incarnation of all evil in one essence. Now back to chapter 17, verse 18. When I called you back last week and gave you a P.S., I hope you were back and remember. The woman, he said, this religious system, Mystery Babylon, is that great city. What great city? Well, Jerusalem is called that great city, and there is certainly the spirit there of Jerusalem, its works, its rejection of Christ. Rome may be in view here with its system of so much that is foreign, we believe, to New Testament Christianity. Historical Babylon, physically, may be in view here. But you will recall that at the end of each of the seven vials, of the seven scrolls, the seven vials and seven trumpets, that what happens is the summation of everything that has happened. So I suggested to you last week that the great city refers to the spirit of Rome, the spirit and theology and practice of historical Babylon, Babel, and the spirit of Jerusalem, which is against Christ, or certainly non-Christ, and that the great city then refers to a spiritual city and an incarnation all at once of everything that has ever been religiously anti-God. And so it is the same way then when you come down to the plagues They're as hard as everything that's always ever been before. The incarnation of this religious system, the great harlot, is as serious and inculcates everything that's been before. And just so I think here, I think the judgment of Babylon, the organized world system of rebellion politically against God, is the incarnation and essence of, spiritually, and the sum total of, all the rebellion that has ever gone on before. And it is so bad when God judges it that he gives it twice what it ever gave out throughout all of history. Now with that background, gee, that's enough for a whole sermon, isn't it? All right. With that background, let's jump in and look at some verses here. And I want to tell you, this is a long chapter, but it will go very quickly. The two major portions only need to be read with one or two small comments. All right? And so the destruction of the spirit of organized, political, world confederation of rebellion against God, crushed once and for all, which is culminated by the Antichrist as they all come to destroy what is the essence of God's revelation of himself through all the Judeo-Christian faith, is smashed once and for all. So here's the judgment of that world system of organized rebellion politically against God. Verse 1. And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven. Now let's keep in mind, let's look at the word angel, that this is prophetical language. It is some things I think we can firmly say, I really with conviction believe that's literal. Because it's so obvious. We have seen, have we not? So much obvious. And so much explained clearly from other parts of Revelation and particularly of the Old Testament. But some is obviously metaphorical, allegorical, mystical, and is illusionary and unsure. And we've seen already, you will recall, that an angel, the word angel here is used once, I mean several times. I remember this moment ago coming in, so I don't know where it is, but I do recall we have also studied and seen the expression angel used once for Jesus, remember? Now, in the Old Testament, there's somebody who appears often who's called the angel of the Lord. Now, we think that this may be just a name for pre-incarnate Old Testament appearances of Jesus because he always acts like Jesus. But now, if you ever heard anything, hear this. This is symbolic language. I'm going to suggest to you the possibility that interchange of terminology is used here, and this angel is a name for Jesus, and that this is Jesus. I'll show you why in a minute. But you must hear this clearly. That is not to say, not to say, not to say that Jesus is an angel or is like an angel. This is symbolic language. And we've seen that already once and then repeatedly in the Old Testament and once in Revelation, he is pictured in the imagery as an angel. Now, why is it important that you understand that Jesus is not an angel? Well, one of the big reasons is, like the man I had lunch with today, who is a Mormon, and the difference in what they believe and what evangelical Christianity believes. Be not deceived, even Satan himself will come formed, transformed as an angel of light. You will see a continued proliferation of confusing miracles, manifestations, everything of Satan as an angel of light, and you won't be able to tell which it is. The New Age movement is full of it, and it's confusing a lot of people. This man was talking about the beauty of Jesus, the greatness of giving your testimony, the joy of preaching the gospel. But folks, the Mormons don't mean what you mean by the gospel. They don't mean what you mean by accepting Christ. They're not talking about the same Christ you are. They don't mean the same Jesus we mean. The Jesus that they're talking about is the one that their doctrine says began
as a human being created by God. Created by God, put in the garden, who evolved into a God, so we can too, they say, and became a God. That is not the doctrine of the New Testament. The doctrine of the New Testament is that Jesus, get this, is not a created being. God did not create Jesus. He was his only begotten Son, only in the sense of his incarnation in the human body for 33 years. But the touchstone, it's no side issue. The watershed of all Christian orthodoxy is that Jesus is, will always be, and has always been fully God, co-equal with God. God didn't create Jesus. Jesus didn't create God. The Father, Son, and Spirit are eternal. They have always been. So don't think for one moment that when we talk about accepting Jesus and they talk about accepting Jesus, that we mean what the Mormons mean. Which Jesus are you talking about accepting? The one who is eternal, God, and has always been the creator of the world, or the one who God created, that they believe, who started out as a man and evolved into God? How important is it? It's only the heart of Christian orthodoxy. If any man deny that Jesus is God in the flesh, co-equal with the Father, he is of Antichrist, John says, and is of the devil. There's a fine line here. I've said that to say this. When I suggest to you that this reference to an angel, and I'll embellish that in a moment, maybe, some of you are saying, what have you been doing the last 5 minutes? Maybe Jesus, remember, I say that in the sense of New Testament apocalyptic imagery, not New Testament theology. And that's very, very important. So I saw this other angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. The word that I am reading, lightened, in my King James Version, does not mean made to weigh less, lightened up, weight removed. It means the earth was illuminated, lighted up. Now, I want to suggest to you that this angel may be Jesus Christ, for three or four reasons. Number one, he is seen as having great power. Two, he has a mighty voice, not just the voice of the angel spoke, a mighty voice. He is the voice of God. Both of those things are not referenced to other angels. Number three, he lightens up the earth. He illuminates the earth. No angel as pictured in the Bible as having such dazzling Shekinah glory that he lights up the whole world. Number four, the Father judgeth no man, but hath committed all judgment to the Son. Is it not reasonable to assume that when the final destruction of the organized world system of rebellion is crushed, that God sends his no less an authority than Jesus to do it himself? Hypothetical, Bassanio's opinion. But here are four reasons why I suggest the possibility Jesus is this mighty angel. And he cried with a mighty voice, with a strong voice, saying, Babylon, the great is fallen. Turn back, if you will, please, to chapter 14, verse 8. And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city. Now in chapter 14, which is parenthetical, we have an overview of what is going to happen. All right?